Perhaps it's a reflection of how old I am. But I keep seeing stories in the media about rapidly rising house prices, and I simply think, here we go again. There are already those out there who are telling us that this is a housing bubble, but it's going to crash. Then there are others who are warning us that the Reserve Bank or APRA are going to interfere, they're going to slow things down. And then the banks that only 12 months ago forecast house price falls of 10%, 15%, 20%, they're now suggesting house prices could rise 10%, 15%, or even 20% this year alone, in some areas. While these periods of rapid house price growth essentially come down to forces of supply and demand, each sprinkled with varying quantities of irrational exuberance, the price forces behind each of our housing booms that I've invested in the past, in, well, close to 50 years, they're never the same. Each cycle's a little bit different. I remember when I bought my first investment property in the early 1970s, inflation boomed, and that was when the Whitlam government came in, and at that time, interest rates were much higher than they were now. They were double-digit interest rates. But inflation had the effect of reducing the real value of mortgages or interest. It was also a time of strong wages growth. Then I remember the great property boom of the late 1980s, which was one of the factors that eventually led to the recession we had to have in the early 90s. And boy, did I do well and have a good time and do a lot of developments in those days. And I particularly remember the property boom in the early 2000s, when investor demand was a significant factor driving up house prices, in part because of the changes at that time that they were talking about bringing in capital gains tax, and there was all concern about how that would affect our property markets. So looking at the current housing boom, there are some interesting features that contrast with previous cycles. The first is population growth is very low at the moment. It's almost non-existent, isn't it? In fact, net migration caused population to fall in Australia. It's only been held up by expats coming back. That's very different to previous booms, particularly the boom in the middle of the last decade, where strong immigration was an important factor in driving house prices, as was the factor that there was lots of overseas foreign investors. Another interesting difference is the relative absence of investors in the current housing boom, not just foreign investors, but local investors. And this is reflected in the much stronger demand for standalone houses rather than apartments this time round, because it's owner occupiers, first home buyers and established home buyers upgrading, that are driving the market this time round. In February this year, investors only made up about 20% of all home loans. They're the latest figures from the time I was recording this, when traditionally it's closer to 30% of all loans are going to investors. And as I said, it's not just local investors. Foreign investors are absent at the moment as well. They're nowhere to be seen this time round. But I think in due course, as our borders open and the world becomes more normal, they'll come back. So far, a significant factor in this particular property boom has been the presence of first home buyers, and they've been assisted by the various federal and state government initiatives, including the Home Builder Program that we've spoken about before, the First Home Loan Deposit Scheme, and lots of other concessions, stamp duty concessions. While our banks are keen to lend to first home buyers, I've heard that the Bank of Mum and Dad is actually now the fifth largest lending institution in Australia. Here, homeowning parents who are sitting on significant equity in their property, they're helping their children getting into the housing markets with gifts, with loans, and they assist by guaranteeing the loans of their children. So how can you make the most of this property cycle that we're currently experiencing? And is the Reserve Bank going to interfere? Is it going to raise interest rates? Will APRA slow down lending like it has in the past, and people are worried about macroprudential controls? Well, that's exactly what we're going to discuss today with my regular guest, finance advisor Stuart Weems. So welcome to today's podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropol, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
Our property markets have been surging this year, with double-digit growth in sight for all our capital cities. And now that more Australians are fairly secure about the economy in general, about their jobs in particular, that's only going to place more impetus under our property markets. And it's clear that FOMO, you know, the fear of missing out when home buyers and investors are scared the market's running away from them, it's clear that FOMO is now driving many decisions. Buyers feel they've got to get into the market. And this is showing with even secondary properties selling well above vendors' expectations. I found in the past, normally at the beginning of a cycle, there's a flight to quality. People remember the type of properties that held their values during the downturn and avoid secondary properties. But currently, I'm seeing some home buyers so worried that the market's going to pass them by that they're starting to compromise on their selection criteria just to get in the market. Unfortunately, we've seen how this ends up when the market eventually slows down, and it's not a pretty sight. So what's ahead for the markets this year, and how can we take advantage of the current property boom without getting burned? There's some of the questions I'd like to ask my regular guest, independent finance advisor Stuart Weems, author of Investopoly and Rules of the Lending Game. Hi, Stuart.
Hey, Michael. Fantastic to be back with you again.
Well, Stuart, these have become amongst the most popular of my podcast sessions, so I really enjoy our chats. And as I said in the introduction, many of the bank economists are now expecting our markets to rise significantly. But at the end of last year, the government announced it would scrap responsible lending rules. It wanted to speed up the loan approvals. It wanted to eliminate those one-size-fits-all approach that the banks had that stifled lending, and wanted to give banks more discretion. But Stuart, at that time, our property markets were hamstrung by the coronavirus-induced slowdown. But if these recommendations become law now, is that going to add further fuel to our property markets? What's going to happen?
Well, I think it could. And if we think about how COVID has impacted the economy and particularly property buyers and property owners, we know from the RBA that the lowest 40% of income earners have worn 100% of the COVID burden. That is their incomes. That's where most of the unemployment is centered. And that's where, you know, people that have had income reductions, it's been lower income earners rather than higher. And in fact, the top 40%, their income's higher today than it was pre-COVID. So they're doing much better. And if we think about then the responsible lending changes, the responsible lending changes go to the situation where a bank is obliged to get an understanding of what your current expenditure levels are. And so historically, or at least the last couple of years, they've trawled over bank statements and just to try to sort of ascertain, I guess, you know, what your regular expenses are. And it invites questions like, oh, you know, do you have a Netflix commitment of $10 a month, for example? And, you know, there's been lots of different stories of how insane it can get. The court, when there was a case that ASIC tried to prosecute Westpac with, the court suggested, well, what you're spending today doesn't really tell me very much about your ability to service a loan. And in fact, if you are, it could call the Wagyu and Shiraz case. So the judge said, in fact, if you are eating the finest Wagyu and washing it down with the finest Shiraz, arguably that indicates that you do have surplus capacity to take on additional debt. And there was a lot of other changes in that bill, but from a borrowing capacity perspective, that was the main change. And if we think logically about it, higher income earners have the most to gain from this change, because as a higher income earner, maybe I'm spending $150,000 a year on general living or $200,000, but a lot of it is discretionary. But when I turn up to the bank and say, okay, and they'll see $10,000, $15,000 a month I'm spending on these items and these things, going out to holidays, whatever it might be, discretionary expenditure. Now, if the bill goes through, essentially what that means is that the banks might be able then to adopt a benchmark living expense. So they might say, okay, look, even though Stuart has a high income and he's spending a lot more, we know that he could probably live off $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year. So when we calculate his borrowing capacity, that's exactly the amount that we'll use. And so if then pre these changes, they were including 150, and after this change is, if let's say they're just going to assume my living expenses are 60, then the differential, the $90,000 goes towards funding additional borrowing capacity. So we're very sensitive then, higher income earners are very sensitive to what that living expense assumption is. And so higher income earners have the greatest to gain out of these changes. And since higher income earners are probably the ones that are in the market, you know, fueling the demand at the moment, then my reading of it, I mean, it all depends. I mean, they'll change the law and then it depends on how the banks will implement it, of course, which we need to see. I think it'll have a pretty significant impact, particularly in those blue chip areas.
Well, having the extra income showing of 40, 50, 60 or 100,000 like you gave as an example of, that has a huge multiplier effect and allows you to borrow lots more money, doesn't it?
It does. It's really significant. It could be a 50, 60, 70% increase in borrowing capacity. It is significant. And then if we think about, then that comes at a time when, for example, for owner-occupiers, you know, we can have fixed rates of less than 2%, then the ability to pay more, you know, if I need to borrow an extra couple hundred thousand dollars, in the scheme of things, just based on today's rates, it's not a big deal. You know, I've got that additional spending power and I can put it to work.
Sure. So again, if these come into law, then it will add fuel to our property markets. And that's already leading people to say the Reserve Bank's going to interfere, even though Governor Philip Lowe says, no, we're not. And it says APRA is going to introduce macroprudential controls. So let's have a quick talk about both of those. First of all, the Reserve Bank, would it increase interest rates? It's said that it won't. And I can see one of the reasons it won't is because it wants to get inflation up, it wants to get unemployment down and wages growth. But also, the governments would suffer if interest rates went up. The federal government's borrowings are now going to reach somewhere to close to $1 trillion, meaning a 1% rise in interest rates could cost the government an additional $10 billion a year. And that's not an attractive prospect. So it's not just you and me who are going to have to pay more. The government's borrowings would cost them more.
And you want to keep rates low so that businesses invest and grow, and that's the way you're going to grow employment. And the RBA has said very recently that they, you know, they need to grow employment. They need to get to full employment to create some wage inflation, which will then create some core inflation. And that's their reason why they're not going to increase interest rates. But also, if we think about, you know, unfortunately, COVID accentuates the disparity of wealth in Australia. You know, again, the lowest income earners have worn most of the burden of all the shutdowns and so forth. And to some degree, a lot of higher income earners are in a much better position because they haven't been spending money on holidays and going out and these sorts of things. So if we increase interest rates, higher income earners will probably just suck it up. It won't be such a big deal and probably won't actually have any impact on their demand and for borrowings or for spending. But the people, the lower income earners, the people that can least afford an interest rate increase will be hurt the most. I mean, increasing interest rates is a bit of a blunt instrument, and that's the problem, is that we've got two kind of cohorts in the economy at the moment, one that's doing very well and one that's trying to recover from COVID, and increasing interest rates is going to hurt that cohort.
So people are saying, okay, the Reserve Bank won't. The Governor Philip Lowe said so often that he won't. He'd look pretty silly if he increased interest rates. So maybe it's APRA's turn. Now, recently, Chairman of APRA, Wayne Beyer, came out and said, no, APRA's primary responsibility is financial stability, not soaring house prices. And currently, at least, it's seeing that activity isn't compelling it to intervene. But I know a number of commentators are suggesting there will be a role for changing potential lending standards. And I know you commentated not just in your podcasts and your blogs, but also for the national newspaper, The Australian. And not that I read newspapers anymore, but I love reading your column online. And I think you're one of the ones who thinks macroprudential controls may be coming in later in the year, Stuart.
It's probably the only way that you're going to cool the market. Now, I guess what the government and the RBA will be concerned on, and really APRA, because it really goes to prudential regulation, is that are people speculating in the property market? Now, obviously, homeowners can do that to some extent, but mostly it's going to be investors that arguably might speculate. And the speculation might be that, you know, the Australian economy underlying is doing really well, that low interest rates will persist, and that low interest rates will lead to higher asset prices, higher property prices. So let's jump in now, let's gear to our eyeballs, go and buy as much property as we can buy because we think assets are, you know, the prices are going to rise in the future. and interest rates won't change. If the government starts to see signs of that, that's what will concern them. They don't want people speculating. Now, if people are upgrading, because typically when we go and buy a home, we typically make long-term decisions, or at least more longer term rather than compared to investment speculators. So I don't think they're that concerned with that. I think we've got to put the price growth in context, Michael. I mean, we look at median house prices over the last since 18, 19 and 20. Really, if you compare between 18 and 21, there's no real change. There's 3 years of lost growth, if you like, and maybe we're seeing some of that lost growth, you know, transpire. And all markets have, you know, strong mean reversion. You know, in periods of very low or no growth are followed by periods of strong growth. So none of this should be a surprise. But of course, the papers love to write about, you know, how property is unaffordable.
Well, you mentioned mean reversion. So let's just look at that a bit, because if you go back 40 years, and that's about how long the current reasonably good statistics go back, on average, capital city property values in the three big capital cities did around 8%. Melbourne and Sydney did a bit better than Brisbane, but that happened on average. High interest rates, low interest rates, different governments gone to war, recessions, GFC. That's what happened over the long term. And of course, not all properties went up in value, not all locations went up, but that's what it did on average. So the suggestion is that it's likely, the longer that's been happening, the longer it's going to continue. And so I think what I read between the lines of what you were saying is we've had a period of lower growth the last 3 years. Really, we're only catching up to the 2017 peaks now in all our capital cities other than Perth. So it's time to catch up a little bit just to get back to the mean, to the averages. Is that what you were hinting at?
That's what I'm hinting at. Now, I guess when we read the papers and we see properties in eastern Sydney selling for $1.5 million above reserve and these sorts of things, I don't think that explains those sorts of things. I think there is some FOMO going on out there, and people are being driven, you know, to jump in and pay silly prices. But, you know, sometimes, particularly for home buyers, price isn't the most important aspect. You know, if they want to get into a particular area or they fall in love with a particular house, you know, they will be driven by emotion. So it doesn't explain everything that's going on out there. I think there's an element of FOMO, but also I think we've got to put it in context. And if we had have seen 7-8% growth over the last 3 years, and we never see it on a straight line basis, of course, Michael, but if we adjust for that, then prices realistically should be about sort of 20-25% higher today than what they were in 2018. Well, on just a statistical macro level, you know, from a median house price perspective, they're not, right? So we will see some catch-up growth, and arguably that's just catching up to where the intrinsic value of property should be. So we shouldn't be surprised by that fact.
Well, I guess there's two factors affecting our property markets, or there's two ways of looking at the short term, which is very much driven by human emotions and, well, irrationality. And then there's the long-term fundamentals, which are probably easier to quantify, which is really the supply of money, the availability of money, and the wealth of the nation. So over the long term, it's really going to be, if we believe our nation's going to become wealthy and there's going to be more of us, property values are going to keep increasing. But in the short term, it is the fear of missing out, or fear and greed, as there were fear of not getting into the market a couple of years ago. People were just worried what was going on.
Yeah, that's right. And I think if we remind ourselves, you know, 2017 and 2018 were dictated by changes in lending, particularly banks wanting to reduce the amount of interest-only loans. And so, you know, investors were a little bit shy in the market and overall sentiment was low. And then really during 18 and 19, we were leading up to the federal election where Shorten was proposing banning of negative gearing and hiking capital gains tax. So obviously that weighed on the property market, and you know, anyone that wanted to buy a property around that stage was probably thinking, well, Shorten's going to win, I'll do it after the market crashes. Obviously that didn't transpire, and then subsequently we've obviously had last year, which we all know what happened there with COVID. So if I was a property buyer back in, you know, late 17, for example, ready and willing to jump in, there's probably been I won't say some good reasons. There's never a good reason not to buy a great property, but there's been some reasonable reasons why not to do it, to think, oh, I'll do it next year. And then next year comes around and then something new crops up and then they think, well, I'll do it the year after. So that someone that's been sitting on the sidelines ready to get in the property market probably has some reasonable reasons not to have done that for 3 years. And now all of a sudden, all the sentiments changed and all of a sudden I've delayed it. Gee, I better get into the market because if I delay it, I'll have to pay $100,000 more for the same property in 6 months' time. I think that's what's really driving it. But if we think that there's an element of pent-up demand of buyers, that's not going to persist forever. I think you'll have those impatient people that are driven by FOMO that will want to get into the market, but they might dissipate or they might go and buy their property or move out of the market or change their mind over the next 3 or 6 months. And then I think buyer demand might normalize a little bit more.
I agree with you. I see property price growth slowing later this year, not prices going down, but the growth slowing. In fact, if it keeps going at the sort of rates it's been going, the monthly rates, which could, if you multiply it out, equate to 20% growth a year, that is unsustainable and that will lead to a boom. But I believe that if lending changes to the point where maybe their lending standards need to be tightened a bit or there is more speculation, there is a possibility that macroprudential controls are going to be brought in. So let's just have a look at what could be there. This isn't want to be scaremongering, but just to inform our listeners what some of the things that could be done. I mean, we've heard in New Zealand that they've reduced the ability to negatively gear, they've reduced LVRs. So what are the range of things that could occur later this year or next year? And again, we're not saying they will happen, but I think an informed investor has to understand all the options.
That's right. And I think probably an obvious one is to reduce LVR. And the reason I say that is that way you know, people that speculate, so if they're concerned about speculators, short-term speculation in the property market, people that speculate are going to say, okay, well, I want to go and buy as much property as I can. And they're typically then going to try and exhaust whatever equity they have in existing property and or deposit. So if you reduced LVR, then what you're really doing is either limiting people. So you're saying, okay, you can go and buy property, but you can only go buy one because we're going to reduce the LVR to 60% or whatever. Or you're skewing towards people that already have a very strong asset base and they're probably less likely to speculate because speculators are really driven by short-term profit. People that are driven by short-term profit want a shortcut. And the people that want a shortcut typically have a lower asset base. They just want to fast track it. They're impatient. They want to get there. And so I think limiting LVR is probably the most likely outcome. The other thing they could change, the other two that they could change is the benchmark interest rate used to measure capacity for investors. So obviously a benchmark interest rate is what the interest rate the bank assumes that you will pay, or they'll measure whether you can afford to pay that rate when they measure your borrowing capacity. And it's around 5 or 6% at the moment, obviously a lot higher than what current interest rates are, but they need to build in that buffer, you know, make sure you can afford should rates increase. So what they could do is they could have a lower rate for owner occupiers and a higher rate for investors, and that way manipulate borrowing capacity to say, look, we're willing to lend $500,000 to a homeowner, but only $300,000 to an investor, and then again limit the ability there. Or the other alternative is to try and make it more expensive for investors, so increase interest rates, and they could do that by forcing the banks to hold more capital for investment loans, and that would increase the cost to fund those loans for a bank, and naturally a bank's going to pass those higher costs on to borrowers. So there's probably those things, but I think the LVR restrictions, if we're worried about speculation, probably the most powerful one.
Well, the tighter credit conditions would probably have an immediate dampening effect on the housing market, partly on sentiment, but as you say, the ability to borrow money, because we both recognise that property is a game of finance with some houses thrown in the middle, and the more you can borrow, especially at the lower rates, the more people are going to spend. So what do you feel is likely to be ahead, and what would you be advising somebody who's looking at either upgrading their home or getting into property investment in the future?
Locking in higher valuations now and locking in borrowing limits to current LVR restrictions, I guess would make perfect sense if we thought that there was a risk that they're going to change in the future. Now, obviously, bank valuations are driven by comparable sales. And whilst we might look at some comparable sales today, they've probably all occurred, you know, some good ones. They've probably all occurred in the last few weeks, 6 weeks or so. Bank valuers aren't necessarily persuaded by, you know, that sort of short-term data, and they want to see, they don't want to track the market too closely. So they don't want to do a valuation today and think, oh, the property's worth 600 and then something sells next weekend for more. Okay, then the property's worth 650. They don't want to track that. They want to see a sort of sustained level of increased prices. So if it was me, it's going to depend on the type of property and location. But putting that aside, if it was me, I would aim to revalue my properties sometime over the next 2 or 3 months and then lock in my borrowing capacity to 80% of those valuations. And I think that would make sense to do at any time, really. The more access you have to money, and if an opportunity arises, the better position you'll be. But it also, if we think things are going to change, it makes sense to do it. And I would say even do it even if you don't have any particular plans to use that money. You just never know what is around the corner. And having access to money might be an advantageous thing, depending on what happens to property prices and the property market.
Now, what's showing through in your advice is your holistic approach to investing. So those who don't know you well, and I'm going to give them a link in the show notes to understand that, you're coming from the advice of A, being a property investor, so you actually know what you're talking about, but you've got the accounting background, the financial planning background. I know your team also does finance strategists. So that's a very holistic approach. And what you're doing is you're strategizing and planning, which I think is the way people are going to get ahead in this market, because a rising tide doesn't always lift all ships. Not all properties are going to do well. And we know what's going to happen as this cycle finishes. And if it actually goes as fast as it is, it means it's going to be a shorter cycle this time round, Stuart. So some people are already probably wondering, is it too late? Have I missed it? And I know we have spoken about it before, but I think this is an ideal time to talk again about how important or not timing the market is. And I know you did some great research on that. So what advice would you give to somebody who's wanting to get the timing right?
2016 was a pretty strong market. Between the start of 2016 and the end of 2016, early 2017, prices jumped considerably. And then, as I've just spoken about, what happened over 17, 18, 19, 20, a lot of a series of very unexpected events occurred consecutively over that period of time. So it's quite possible that if someone got a bit of FOMO in mid-16, thinking, oh, gee, I better get into the property market, prices are rising, it's quite possible that they would have been sitting on a paper loss, like if they looked at what they paid for the property and what the property would be worth, for maybe a couple of years after owning that property. Now, whether that's material, I mean, that's inconsequential if you want to own if you're going to own the property for 20 or 30 years, who cares? And if you've got the right property, it's not going to upset the strategy. But I guess the point is that we should be diligent when selecting an investment asset and not rush in either direction. So we shouldn't delay it for any other reason, but we shouldn't also think we need to rush into the market. So people that are concerned because they've been to a few auctions and they've sold for significant amounts, we have to remind ourselves that prices can move in two directions, not just one. And sometimes our fear and our worry allows us to forget that. And we think, oh, just prices are only going to go up. But it's quite possible that in a few months' time, what that property sold for last weekend will look a little overpriced. Now, I'm not suggesting that price is really any component towards whether you're going to be a successful investor. Paying 5% more for a fantastic asset is going to be worth it in 20 or 30 years. We don't necessarily want to go and pay more than 5%, but if I have to overpay to get a really good quality asset, I'm not worried about it, because I know if I've got a good quality asset, the additional compounding growth rate over a 30-year period will dwarf, absolutely, it would be a drop in the ocean of whatever I've overpaid. But I think let's just be diligent. Let's not worry. I wouldn't worry too much. If you plan to buy an investment property this year, do that. You don't have to buy it in the next couple of months necessarily. But when you find the right property, then be prepared to pay a fair market value for that property. And if they go for stupid amounts, don't participate in that. Be diligent. But we know that the price you pay for a property makes has a very little impact on your overall returns. Over the long term, exactly right.
So in the short term, it's a short term sugar hit. You feel good. You love telling your friends about it. You love showing off how you got a bargain. But over the long term, it's a one off. It's much more important to get that above average capital growth, isn't it?
It's about 20 times more important over a 20 year period. It is significantly important. And look, I guess ego tells us, you know, we like to get a deal. We don't like to look like an idiot overpaying for property. And we want to tell ourselves that, you know, if we're bought for 5% less than what we think it's worth, we've won. Well, that's not a win. It's a win if you need to sell the property tomorrow. But really what we want to do is buy a property that has the fundamentals to double in value every 8 to 12 years. And if we can do that, and if we have to pay slightly more for that property, that's not a big deal.
Yeah. Well, as I've said, I very rarely think I've got a bargain, and I'm in the market again now. And my advice to my buyer's agents who are looking on my behalf is basically I want to buy the best property I can in my budget, and the price is nowhere near as important as I've found over the years. If I find the right property, I'm not in a hurry to find the right property, but when I find the right property, I'll be in a hurry to secure it. And I know I'm not going to get a bargain today. Moving forward, there's discretionary vendors. We always have people who have to sell, and there's people who don't have to sell, but as the market picks up, they start to sell because they want to upgrade their home, change their lifestyle, move to a better location, and they're going to be encouraged by these recent results. They're not going to want to sell cheaper than the guy down the road, but it will mean there's going to be more supply coming into the market as the year moves on. Currently, for every new property coming onto the market, it seems that 1.1 properties are sold. In other words, the amount of stock available for purchase is decreasing, but it looks like that's starting to pick up now. So don't worry too much. Get your ducks in a row right first. So property investment is a journey. It's a process. It's not an event. So you've got to get yourself organized first by getting your finance in place, because in this market, you can't do that afterwards. You've got to get your ownership structures in place, get a good team around you, and don't rush in. But when the right thing happens, yes, you've got to take action, don't you, Stuart?
And I think you make a really good point there, Michael. We typically, or most people typically, are very reactionary to finance. They let the decision to buy an asset drive their finance decisions. Whereas, as I think we've spoken about today, is that we can be a bit more proactive with finance, knowing that finance is the key driver. The more investment capital I have, the more I can invest. And if I do that well, the more wealth that I will build. So just encourage people to really think about finance first. Then you'll have all your ducks lined up in a row. And then when the right property comes along, when you feel you're ready to make that decision, you've got everything organized, you can get into the market.
Which means don't just walk into a bank. You can't do it. You need somebody who's a finance expert, and that's what your team does. In fact, you've written a book about the rules of the lending game. So if people want to understand more about the rules of the lending game, how do they find out about it, Stuart?
Well, we can include a link in the show notes, of course, but also just Google ProSolution Private Clients, which is my business. All the books are on the website. And if you use the discount Yardney, your surname, of course, then we'll send them a book for $20, no postage.
Sure. Or they can speak to you or your team about getting involved in finance and having a strategic plan. And I know, like our team at Metropole, you take that holistic approach. It's not just finance, but you look at the whole position, which is why I love chatting with you. So you've given us some great insights. It'll be interesting to see how the market pans out. We'll catch up again real soon. Thanks for your time today, Stuart.
Been fun again. Thanks, Michael.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Stuart, and in a moment I'm going to share with you my mindset message. But before I do, since you're listening to this podcast, and I assume you're interested in property investment, money and success, I've just got a way of saying thank you to you for taking the time out of your busy day to listen to me. So I'd like to gift you a wide range of ebooks to add to your success library. So just go to podcastbonus.com.au and leave me your details, and you're going to get access to a range of my ebooks. I'll leave a link in the show notes, podcastbonus.com.au, and you can download the ebooks right away. And if you're wanting to take advantage of the opportunities that the current property markets are presenting, like I was discussing with Stuart a moment ago, why not spend 5 days with me and a team of my experts on the Gold Coast at Wealth Retreat in June? It's actually coming up real soon, June 6th to 12th on the Gold Coast this year. We've been running Wealth Retreat since 2006. I'm sure we missed out last year, but we've booked the room and it's all going to happen this year. And you can spend 5 intensive days with Dr. Andrew Wilson, Ken Race, Simon Kirstenmacher, Pete Warchant and Tom Cawley are going to be appearing virtually because of they're stuck overseas. Business, tax, finance, property, share market experts. But it's actually a small group environment. It's not a big event, and it will help you plan the next 5 years of your life. You see, Wealth Retreat isn't really a property seminar. It's about you. It's my exclusive retreat designed for anybody who wants to accomplish something bigger in their life. It's for people who stuck with, maybe they've reached a bit of a plateau, maybe they had some stumbling blocks in 2020, and it's for other successful people who just want to go to the next level, who want to make a big shift, not just in property, not just in their business, but in their lives in general. So if this sounds like you, whether it's with regard to your property investment business, your entrepreneurial endeavors, I'd love to help make your dreams come true. Because you're going to get my personal insights, my personal feedback on your plans, and you're going to receive elite mentorship that's going to take your life from being great to being outstanding. Hey, there's no excuses why you can't do it this year. It's the beginning of a new property cycle, the beginning of a new business cycle. So don't count yourself out. Sure, most of the people at Wealth Retreat are already very highly successful business people, entrepreneurs and investors, but they leave their Superman capes at the front door. There's no egos. And I interview everybody who wants to come to Wealth Retreat to make sure it would work for them, because I actually give a personal money back guarantee, which I've never ever had to give. So I want to make sure it will work for you and that you'll suit the Wealth Retreat community. So go to wealthretreat.com.au, find out about it, register your interest, and I'd love to spend 5 days on the Gold Coast with you. And it's over a long weekend, so many people won't even miss out on much work. Wealthretreat.com.au.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In my mindset message today, I'd like to point out that we all fail. And my suggestion to you is don't worry too much about failing. Over the years, I've had more than my share of failures, some of them self-inflicted. In fact, sometimes I say I'm a real success at failure. But I've come to realize that too many people worry about getting it wrong, about failing. So I'd like to share with you 6 reasons why failing, why not working out right, why getting it wrong is overrated. Firstly, failing is never permanent. I know about that sinking feeling you get in your tummy. I've had it too, but it won't last forever. The best way to reflect on your failures is to focus on the lessons you've learned and the person you've become, rather than try to spend time avoiding failure. The less time you spend on the rejection, the faster you're going to grow. The second lesson I'd like to point out why failure is overrated is it's a good opportunity to own up to your failures. The moment you openly talk about the things that make you vulnerable, they no longer have power over you. People will appreciate your honesty because everyone knows what it's like when they've had setbacks or when they've made mistakes. Others are going to respect you for owning up to your problems and embracing your failures. And that makes you stronger. The third thing I'd like to share with you about failure is the world won't change unless you do. The world owes you nothing. It was here first. We can't blame the world for the shortfall in our lives. We can't blame the people around us or the past decisions we've made about what's happening to us now. It's not the event that defines who you are. It's how you choose to react to it. So forget what others say They're going to judge you anyway. If you want to change the world, change yourself first. The fourth lesson about failure I'd like to share with you at the moment is ask yourself the question, how badly do you want it? I remember Steve Jobs once said, if you don't love it, you'll fail. I mean, you've heard that Thomas Edison made 1,000 unsuccessful attempts at inventing the light bulb. But from his perspective, he said he didn't fail 1,000 times. The light bulb was an invention that took 1,000 steps. So when things go wrong, ask yourself that question. How badly do I want it? And you get up one more time. Another thing I'd like you to remember is just because you failed doesn't mean you're a failure. Never let failure deteriorate your own self-worth. If your head hurts, you say, I have a headache. You don't say, I am a headache. Failure is nothing more than an event. So don't personalize it. And the last lesson I'd like to mention about failure today is that it's just part of the process. The fastest way to succeed is to double your failure rate. Successful people have failed more times than a beginner has ever tried. So my message today in this mindset moment is, if you want to succeed, fail faster. As we're getting close to the end of another show, I just want to remind you about the offer I made where you can get access to a wide range of ebooks to add to your success library. Just go to podcastbonus.com.au, leave me your details, and you'll get instant access to a range of ebooks from me and some other wealth experts. Now, if you got benefit from today's show, why not help somebody else who'd also benefit from hearing the great advice that Stuart gave and my insights if you found them useful as well? Tell them about the Michael Yardney podcast or leave a review wherever you listen to this podcast or use the share button on the podcast app. Now, I'm back twice a week, but if you want to find out more in between, just follow me on social media, look for Michael Yardney, or subscribe to my daily property update newsletter. I'm actually surprised how many people listen to this podcast but don't get benefit from the daily newsletter, a briefing from not just me but a whole range of experts. propertyupdate.com.au. And of course, if you'd like to get a daily snippet, something exclusive, our private Facebook group is exactly where you should head. Just go to Facebook, look for the Property Update Facebook group, and I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney podcast, which was brought to you by Metropol, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropol to help you?